This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
In just 2 weeks, the Summer Olympics start in Rio de Janeiro, and it's anyone's guess whether Brazil is ready. The country is in the middle of a terrible recession, its president has gone through lengthy impeachment proceedings, and a corruption scandal at the national oil company, Petrobras, has ended the careers of numerous politicians and well-connected insiders. All of this is a long way from where Brazil was just a few years ago. Back then, the economy was soaring, and Alex Quadros was writing about the people at the very top as a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's now written a book called Brazilianaires: Wealth, Power, and Hope in an American Country. In it, he writes about trying to pin down the net worth of a particularly flamboyant billionaire.
Part of my job as a quote-unquote billionaires reporter, which was this strange job that I kind of randomly lucked into, was to calculate billionaires' net worths for the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. And when it came time to calculate Ike Batista's net worth, during the process, he was so intent on showing how much he was worth that his people listed, you know, the private jets he owned, the yachts, and sent accompanying photos. A lot of it was pretty straightforward because he owned shares in big publicly traded companies, but they argued with us on one point. We were trying to put the value on a gold company that owned gold deposits in Colombia, but had yet to extract an ounce of gold from the ground. So we compared it to other similar companies and determined it was worth slightly less than $1 billion. He said that it was worth $5 billion. And we decided to go with our number, and he got so upset over this that on the eve of the launch of the index, he called me personally to try and convince me that I was wrong and proceeded to yell at me for like 15, 20 minutes and telling me how it had a lot more gold than we knew about and how he was going to make me look very foolish and how he would tweet that I was lying about his assets. And during that conversation, he even called me primitive, which is the only time a billionaire has ever called me a name.
Why write about the billionaires?
It wasn't something that I was that interested in before. Before I started working for Bloomberg, I was a lot more interested in writing about the poor. But what I realized is that I had actually stumbled onto a really unique way of looking at the country at this kind of special moment that it was having. And not only that, but I had stumbled onto a story that's important well beyond Brazil. I got a kind of access to people that very few people get to talk to on a regular basis, billionaires.
Well, what can they teach you? What can a billionaire of a country teach you about a country?
When you talk to a Brazilian billionaire, you learn a lot about ideas of success, where success comes from. You learn a lot about the ideals of the country. To go back to Ike Batista, when I spoke to him after he was done yelling at me, he told me, you know, what's happening in Brazil right now is the Brazilian dream, and I happen to be the example of that dream. He expressed this idea, a very new idea in Brazil, which is a country with terrible inequality and social stratification, that anyone could get rich if they tried hard enough and worked hard enough and so on, which is obviously a very common mythology in the United States, but something very new there. Now, what's interesting about this is that it was just that, a myth. I mean, his dad was a government minister, served as CEO of Vale, the mining giant. Ike liked to say that he grew up middle class, but he grew up with access to things that one in 1,000 or 100,000 or a million Brazilians grow up with.
Why do you think things started to unravel?
Partly luck and partly bad decisions. The luck part is that commodity prices started to come down. China's economy started to slow, and, you know, oil and iron ore and beef started to be worth less on global markets. So that was a big blow to Brazil. The bad decisions part is that Dilma Rousseff, who was president from 2011 and is currently being impeached and may definitively be forced to step down very soon, pursued a very strange idea of economic development. I think we hear outside of Brazil a lot about the social programs of those years under her and Lula.
We hear, direct payments to the poorest of the poor. We hear about that. But you actually wrote about sort of her economic strategy. Clearly, you feel like it was sort of misguided. So tell me why.
The strangest contradiction in this ostensibly left-wing movement is that they thought the state could guide economic development by funneling subsidies to the sectors they favored. The problem is that they didn't discriminate very much, and they funneled hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies to billionaire-owned companies through tax breaks, through subsidized low-interest government loans. And what it seems like some researchers believe to have happened is not that this increased investments, because while she was doing this, the economy started to sputter and finally plunge into recession, but it just helped increase profit margins for these companies. And at the same time, it saddled Brazil with this massive debt. And Brazil is a country with very high interest rates. So shortly before Dilma was forced to step down because of the impeachment proceedings, but by her last year in office, her government was spending just on interest payments the equivalent of 12 years of the Bolsa Família welfare program.
You know, with the exception of Dilma, all of the main characters in this book are male. And when you talk about billionaires giving you a window into national goals and identities and themes, boy, it was really hard to read this as a woman and not be like, wait, where are the women in here? Were you struck by that in reporting it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very male book, but not through my choice, but because this is a reflection of what wealth looks like in Brazil. I do profile one very rich woman, but she inherited her fortune from her husband. When you look at the billionaire rankings in Brazil, you're seeing a picture of the entrenched inequality and machismo in the country.
And race. Most of the people are white. Yeah.
Not a single Brazilian billionaire is black. And, you know, this is, I think, a surprise to some outsiders who see Brazil as this example of racial harmony. But in fact, racism is just quieter there. It's a lot more subtle. There's a rapper named Emicida who says that what's hard is to fight this cordial kind of racism.
What does that mean, cordial racism?
There's a cliche about the archetypal Brazilian that he's the cordial man. This is partly a reference to how business has always been done in the country based on personal relationships rather than through impersonal institutions. But there's also a mythology of the Brazilian within Brazil as innately friendly and warm and welcoming. But oftentimes this friendliness is covering up deep social inequalities and problems. And racism is one of those things.
So I spent 2 weeks in Brazil in 2015 making a documentary. And one of the things that came up again and again was this idea of sort of inside-outside, that for a lot of Brazilians, mostly middle-class people, that inside the home life had improved. So people had TVs and refrigerators and, you know, nice stuff, and families had better housing. But outside the home, in terms of social services and transportation and education and healthcare, that they hadn't. I'm curious whether that tracks with your reporting. And if it does, when that outside part is going to fall into place.
Well, absolutely. And I think that one of the biggest failures of the Workers' Party years was not to invest more in the outside the home part of life for working class Brazilians. They pushed huge subsidies to a beer company, to the subsidiary of the world's largest beer company, which is controlled by a Brazilian billionaire named Jorge Paulo Lehmann. But they failed to do enough to extend basic sanitation to, you know, poor rural homes and even poor urban homes. Half the population lacks access to basic
sanitation. And we're talking
about
a government that at one point was led by an ex-unionist and another point an ex-left-wing guerrilla.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a very interesting moment because we have the Olympics coming up, and the Olympics are emblematic of this kind of decision making. The authorities in Brazil, from the president, Dilma, on down to the mayor of Rio, decided that they were going to invest hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, if you include the World Cup stadiums, in sporting facilities. And this was very good for the well-connected billionaire construction families who built them and for the local politicians who got to spread the funds around. But it doesn't make much sense when there are these urgent infrastructure needs of poor Brazilians. And it fits into this strange trickle-down idea of development.
I'm not going to ask you if Brazil can pull the Olympics off because I don't think that's a question we can answer right now. I want to know what you think the legacy of the campaigning for these Olympics will be and the things that were built or not built for them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when Brazil won the right to hold the Olympics in 2009, it was a party. People were celebrating on Copacabana Beach in Rio. Now the feeling about the Olympics is very different. Obviously, there were huge protests over the World Cup. Now people aren't protesting, but I think only because they've kind of been beaten down too much by their circumstances. You know, so I hope one legacy of this will be skepticism about these kind of glorious, hubristic plans presented to them by their leaders. More concretely, when we look at the city of Rio, it's going to be a legacy that disproportionately benefits a wealthier slice of the population. In a city where 1 in 7 people live in favelas, they decided to put the lion's share of Olympic investments in a wealthy suburb called Barra da Tijuca, where only 300,000 people live. So the single most expensive Olympic project is a subway extension that connects Ipanema and Leblon, two of the fanciest
neighborhoods,
to Barra da Tijuca, this wealthy suburb, and neglected other parts of the city that woefully need this kind of thing.
Alex Quadros is the author of Brazilianaires. Thank you very much.
Thank you.